Deadline's Iran's foreign minister urges the Taliban government to remove, quote, artificial barriers that prevent the realization of Tehran's water rights from the Helmand, the river. The scandal surrounding the Israeli spyware Pegasus deepens as the European Commission says phones of some of its top officials were compromised by the malware. Also ahead, activists and the family of slain Palestinian journalist Shireen Abu Akleh urged the U.S. to hold Israel accountable for her killing amid international outcry over Washington's inaction on the case. Welcome to World News from the reigning capital, Tehran. It's good to have you with us. Our top story this hour, Iran's foreign minister urges the Taliban government in Afghanistan to remove all artificial barriers that prevent the realization of Iran's water rights from the Helmand River. Hossein Amir Abdullahian made the comment in a phone call with the acting Afghan foreign minister, Amir Khan Muttaqi. He said realizing Iran's water rights would be an indication of the Taliban's commitment to its international obligations. The top Iranian diplomats added that a delay in resolving this problem would have negative impacts on other areas of cooperation between the two countries. Amir Abdullahian said a high-ranking delegation will soon visit Kabul for consultations with Afghan officials on the issue. On Wednesday, President Ibrahim Raisi also called for a serious pursuit of the country's water rights from the Helmand River. He said Iran has to secure its rights in order to meet its water needs, especially in the border province of Sistan and Balochistan. The spyware Pegasus is in controversy again. An investigation by the European Commission has reportedly found signs indicating that phones of some top EU officials were hacked using the Israeli malware. No further details are available as the investigation is still ongoing, but media reports have cited a letter by the EU Justice Commissioner that he was alerted by Apple last year of a possible hacking of his smartphone by Pegasus. The letter, which was sent to a Dutch member of the European Parliament, however, said that an initial probe did not confirm the malware succeeded in infecting the devices of he or other staff. Pegasus is produced by an Israeli firm, NSO, and can switch on a phone's camera or microphone. The company is known for selling Pegasus to government clients worldwide to spy on activists, politicians, journalists, and even heads of states. Activists and the family of slain Palestinian journalist Shireen Abu Akleh have gathered in front of the U.S. Congress calling on Washington to hold Israel accountable for her killing. Abu Akleh was shot dead by Israeli fire in May while she was covering the regime's military raid in the Jenin refugee camp in the occupied West Bank. International lawyers, Shireen's family, and a group of House representatives have censured the U.S. administration for its inaction on the assassination.
My name is Anton Abu Akleh, and Shireen was my little sister. When President Biden was coming to Jerusalem earlier this month, I thought for sure he would meet with us. A U.S. citizen, a prominent journalist, beloved by millions of people, was killed by a highly trained Israeli soldier. President Biden was 10 minutes away. He never came to see us. So we had to come here to Washington with support from a community of wonderful people who share our commitment to justice for Shireen. President Biden still hasn't agreed to meet us. We need him to hear from us directly so that he understands the pain our family and too many other Palestinians have endured. President Biden has the power to make sure that this doesn't happen again. We need him to follow his words with meaningful action. Shireen deserves justice, and our demand remains the same, a U.S. investigation that leads to real accountability.
Reports from the United Nations, the New York Times, CNN, and many others have concluded that Israeli soldiers killed my aunt Shireen. There is no doubt. We want to know who pulled the trigger and why, and we want there to be accountability for the system that gave the green light. Journalists should never be targeted while doing their job, no matter which country they're reporting from.
As is Israel's practice, they tried to deflect and to deny responsibility. And in Shireen's case, despite the presence of numerous witnesses, they tried to do the same. Numerous newspapers and organizations had conducted investigations and concluded that an Israeli soldier killed Shireen. Despite all of these reports and despite the promises made, the U.S. has yet to conduct an independent, transparent investigation, nor hold Shireen's killers or the government that killed her responsible. As a result, the family has come here to seek an investigation, to seek justice, to seek accountability for Shireen's murder. It's shocking to me that they had to come here rather than the U.S. administration going to them. They had to come over here to seek justice rather than the other way around.
Every human killed, American or not, deserves justice, Palestinians included, Black folks included. We want answers. We need to ensure that these answers are accurate, that they are transparent, and that they are timely. It has been 2 months since Shireen's death, and we have yet to hold her perpetrators accountable. The State Department released their statements of the summation of the Israeli and PA investigations, but that is not enough, nor is it what our request has been from the beginning.
The U.S. must commit to launching its own credible, independent investigation. I echo the family's call for the Biden administration to have this investigation led by the FBI and the Department of Justice, including the Human Rights and Special Prosecution Section, which are tasked with investigating war crimes against U.S. citizens.
Well, French President Emmanuel Macron is hosting Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman for talks in Paris, despite outrage over the prince's complicity in the murder of dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi. Bin Salman arrived in France after a stopover in Greece and following a visit by U.S. President Joe Biden to Riyadh earlier this month. The trip is seen as the latest step in the diplomatic rehabilitation of the de facto Saudi ruler, as the West is desperate to find new sources of energy amid tensions with Russia. Moreover, bin Salman's meeting in Paris and his recent talks with Biden show the West's failure to turn the kingdom into a pariah. Macron is facing criticism at home and abroad for inviting MBS, with rights groups and a French presidential candidate calling it deeply inappropriate. Khashoggi's fiancée has also censured Macron for receiving bin Salman at the Elysee Palace. The Chinese president has issued a stern warning to his U.S. counterpart as tensions between Washington and Beijing over Taiwan continue to rise.
Those who play with fire will eventually get burned. I hope the U.S. side can fully understand that. The United States should abide by the One China principle with regard to Taiwan, and ensure that its actions are consistent with its words.
Xi Jinping gave the warning in a phone call with Joe Biden. A dispute over Taiwan has always been a bone of contention between Washington and Beijing. The latest episode is a possible trip by House Speaker Nancy Pelosi to the island. China has said the United States will bear the consequences if the trip goes ahead. Beijing considers Taiwan as part of its territory. It believes U.S. military and political support for the island emboldens its pro-independence forces.
Tensions are rising between China and the United States. Beijing has issued a stern warning against a potential visit by the U.S. House of Representatives Speaker Nancy Pelosi to Chinese Taipei. Beijing says that Washington will be responsible for the consequences of the possible visit. Chinese side has made it clear to the U.S. that it is firmly opposed to Speaker Pelosi's visit to Taiwan. We are fully prepared. If the U.S. goes its own way, China will certainly take firm and forceful measures to safeguard its national sovereignty and territorial integrity, and the U.S. should be held responsible for any serious consequences.
So the idea that she would visit Taiwan at this point is intended to provoke a crisis with China. Recall that the U.S. and the British forced NATO expansion, totally ignoring Russia's security interests with the so-called reverse Cuba Missile Crisis, whose purpose was to provoke Russia into acting against the neo-Nazi regime in Ukraine in order to justify the wildly illegal and self-defeating sanctions, economic warfare against Russia.
Analysts believe the latest warning by China against the visit of the U.S. House Speaker to Chinese Taipei was harsher in tone and very stern. Some say the threats contained an allusion to a possible military confrontation between China and the U.S., and that is why reservations have been raised in Washington about the visit. The U.S. House Speaker was scheduled to visit Taipei earlier in April, but the trip was apparently canceled after she contracted COVID. However, some reports say that Pelosi will make the controversial visit in August. Apart from top Democrats, some hawkish Republicans have also come out in favor of the visit, stressing that this visit is a show of support against China.
This is a very serious crisis. How China responds is very difficult to foresee, but it's a moment in which the literally madmen and women in the West are trying to do to China what they are in the process of doing against Russia.
The problems that exist between China and the U.S. are many. There have been U.S. attempts to militarize the South China Sea region, like arms sales to Japan and Chinese Taipei. The South China Sea Islands, which the U.S. disputes, is another issue. Then there is the issue of Russia, which the U.S. has threatened to sanction China if it continues to buy Russian oil. A trade war and technology are other areas which the U.S. has clashed with China.
There are few people today who doubt that China is a global superpower, both militarily and economically. In terms of the economy, China's economy has continued to grow over the past few decades and is well on its way to overtake the U.S.'s by the year 2030. In terms of military and technology, China is now a superpower on par with the U.S., although Washington's military budget is still the largest in the world. Politicians in Washington who are still dreaming of a unipolar world order that came into existence following the collapse of the Soviet Union do not tolerate the rise of China. The first sign of the unease began to emerge after the former U.S. President Barack Obama announced his pivot to Asia policy, which was meant to counter China's rising influence. Obama's successors, Trump and Biden, have continued Washington's anti-China rhetoric. The two superpowers are locked over a number of issues, including trade and the South China Sea. The bone of contention is Chinese Taipei, and Beijing has made it very clear that it will not allow the self-ruled island to become independent.
It really can only be averted at this point by the nations of the West recognizing that they have no solution to the now terminal breakdown of the dollar system, the hyperinflationary collapse, other than sitting down with Russia and with China in a new Bretton Woods conference to replace the now completely broken and destroyed Bretton Woods system that was set up by Franklin Roosevelt and has been systemically taken apart over these last 30 years.
Chinese Taipei is under China's sovereignty and under the One China policy. The United States and other countries have recognized that sovereignty. But Washington, in violation of its own stated policy, and in an attempt to irritate Beijing, has increased diplomatic contact with the Chinese Taipei.
Well, turning to other news now, Venezuela and Colombia have agreed to restore their diplomatic ties once the newly elected Colombian President Gustavo Petro takes office next week. The move came after Venezuelan Foreign Minister Carlos Faria hosted Colombia's Foreign Minister-elect Alvaro Leyva in a border town on Thursday. The two diplomats expressed their desire to progress on a work agenda towards the gradual normalization by naming ambassadors and consular officials from August the 7th. Relations between the two South American neighbors were broken in 2019 after then Colombian President Iván Duque refused to recognize the re-election of his Venezuelan counterpart Nicolas Maduro. But Petro, Colombia's first ever elected left-wing president, had said on the campaign trail that he would re-establish diplomatic relations with Venezuela once in office. Moving on to the U.S., where the economy has shrunk for a second time since April, fueling fears of a plunge into recession. The U.S. Department of Commerce reported that the GDP fell by 0.9% in the second quarter of this year. This follows a bigger drop in the first 3 months of this year. The IMF also warned that the U.S. economy could dip into a full-on downturn, even with a small shock. Moreover, the fund slashed its U.S. growth forecast to 2.3% this year. U.S. inflation hit a 40-year high in June amid rising food prices, largely blamed on the war in Ukraine. The U.S. Central Bank has been raising interest rates aggressively to deal with the scenario. The Federal Reserve has also said it is preparing for another rate hike. Many have denounced the Europe-wide censorship of Russian media outlet Russia Today as intensely hypocritical. However, the European Union's General Court has just denied an appeal by Russia's RT France to uphold the liberty of the press for all nations. Brings an end to World Bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
The battle to become Britain's next Prime Minister descended into fierce clashes on Monday night, 25th of July, as Rishi Sunak launched repeated attacks on the economic policies of the favourite, Liz Truss, in their first head-to-head television debate. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnists Rajiv Sial, Ben Quinn and Jessica Elgott. The piece is titled Truss and Sunak Trade Blows in Acrimonious First TV Debate. The battle to become Britain's next Prime Minister descended into fierce clashes on Monday night, 25th of July, as Rishi Sunak launched repeated attacks on the economic policies of the favourite, Liz Truss, in their first head-to-head television debate. The two Conservative leadership hopefuls traded blows over tax cuts, over China and inflation, with a former Chancellor, Rishi Sunak, accusing the Foreign Secretary, Liz Truss, of seeking a short-term sugar rush by cutting national insurance. Liz Truss accused her former cabinet colleague of raising taxes to their highest level for 70 years. The exchanges at the BBC debate followed a weekend of deeply personal attacks, with Sunak criticised over his wealth and his wardrobe, as Liz Truss faced claims she was economically illiterate while being reminded that she was formerly a Remainer. Rishi Sunak, widely seen as having to make up crucial ground to win over the Conservative membership, who will vote on 5th of August, repeatedly described his opponent's plans on the economy as not conservative, interrupting her at one point to say, "You promised almost £40 billion of unfounded tax cuts, £40 billion more borrowing. This is the country's credit card. It's our children and grandchildren. Everyone's here who are going to have to pick up the tab for that." Liz Truss hit back over Rishi Sunak's calls for a tougher stance on China, pointing out that the Treasury just last month was calling for closer bilateral and economic ties. Rishi Sunak accused his opponent of making pronouncements about a golden era between China and Britain. "I think that was almost a decade ago," the Foreign Secretary snapped back. Amid reports that Boris Johnson has not yet ruled out a political comeback, despite pledging to step down next month, both candidates also ruled out a role for the current Prime Minister in any government they might lead. "I'm sure he will have a role. I'm sure he will be vocal, but he will not be part of the government," said the Foreign Secretary, despite emphasising that she had been an early supporter of Boris Johnson's. She contrasted her continuing loyalty to him to those of others, adding that it would have been a dereliction of duty not to remain in her post. According to the Daily Telegraph, Boris Johnson told Lord Cruddas at Chequers over lunch on Friday that he wants to fight the next general election as leader of the Conservative Party. Lord Cruddas confirmed. Lord Cruddas is running a campaign to give Conservative Party members a vote on whether to accept Boris Johnson's resignation as Tory leader. But Downing Street responded by insisting that Johnson will leave the post when a new leader is chosen. On Boris Johnson, Liz Truss told the debate, "Having spent time with him this week on foreign affairs, I very much suspect that he would not want a future role in the government. He needs a well-earned break." Rishi Sunak, whose resignation from cabinet on the same day as Sajid Javid precipitated the ousting of Boris Johnson, paid tribute to Johnson as remarkable, but said he had reached a point where enough was enough. "I thought all the things that were going on the conduct side, were not right. And we clearly had different views on the economy side," he said. But with postal ballots set to arrive on Tory members' doorsteps by 5th of August, Rishi Sunak faced pressure to use the BBC debate and another hosted by Talk TV and The Sun on Tuesday to make an early breakthrough. Although he comfortably won the leadership race among Tory MPs, Liz Truss is the favourite to win after a series of opinion polls and surveys put her firmly ahead with party members. Perhaps as a result of this pressure on Rishi Sunak, the debate was particularly bad-tempered, with the former Chancellor often interrupting Liz Truss. At one point she said, "Under my plans, we would start paying back the debt in 3 years' time, so I'm not putting it on the never-never." The former Chancellor interrupted, saying, "That's simply not right," adding, "You promised almost £40 billion of unfunded tax cuts, that is the country's credit card." Liz Truss hit back, saying, "Rishi, that is not true. Under my plans, we would start paying down the debt in 3 years' time. COVID was a one-in-100-years event. No other country is putting up taxes at this moment." The Organisation for Economic Cooperation and Development, the OECD, has described Rishi Sunak's policies as contradictory. In the aftermath of the debate, supporters of Liz Truss argued that Sunak's interruptions were a result of his entitled background. "He came across like a public school mansplainer," said one. One Sunak supporter claimed that Liz Truss did not understand the economy. She was once again out of her depth, the MP said. Conservative Party grandees spoke out in the hours before the debate, pleading for both parties to resist from trashing the brand. But the tensions that have been building continue to manifest themselves, with Liz Truss declining to distance herself from comments by a supporter, the Culture Secretary Nadine Dorries, who outraged some fellow Tory MPs by comparing Rishi Sunak's Savile Row suit and Prada shoes to Liz Truss's £4.50 earrings from Claire's Accessories. "I'm not going to give Rishi fashion advice. I mean, I have said he's a very well-dressed man. I'm not going to give him fashion advice," said Liz Truss, when challenged about Nadine Dorries' comments. Lord Maud, the former party chair and minister for the Cabinet Office, had told the BBC's PM programme ahead of the debate, "One is obviously going to win the leadership, but if the behaviour of the teams and their language has been uncontrolled and it has damaged the party's standing or the way people see the party, then it could end up being a Pyrrhic victory." He said that the increasingly fractious tone of interventions from the campaign teams over the weekend had begun to appear like a race over who can sound more right-wing, as if that's the only game in town. Allies of Rishi Sunak said it was no secret that he had to make a significant impression in the debate, with opinion polls suggesting he's trailing his rival. But one campaign source said the polling from both YouGov and Conservative Home showed a wider gulf between the candidates than they had detected, and said many members were currently undecided. Liz Truss has strictly limited her broadcast appearances and has thus far declined to be interviewed by veteran political journalist Andrew Neil, who will go head-to-head with Rishi Sunak on Friday. Channel 4 said it was still hoping to convince Liz Truss to take part. Allies of Rishi Sunak have suggested he will take numerous broadcast opportunities in order to highlight one of his own strengths versus Liz Truss's perceived weakness. In previous multi-candidate debates, Liz Truss has polled badly with the general public, whereas Rishi Sunak came top in one debate and second in another. Earlier on Monday, 25th of July, Sunak teased his rival with a tweet, "Just me then," and a wink as Channel 4 announced the interview with Andrew Neil. Liz Truss's refusal echoed that of Boris Johnson, who refused to be interviewed by Andrew Neil during the 2019 general election campaign. Rishi Sunak and Liz Truss will take part in another head-to-head debate on Talk TV on Tuesday night and face off again at the first of members' hustings in Leeds on Thursday night.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are...
A Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you. You are very special. And I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, dear listeners, my very dear sisters. Welcome to the realm of ladies. You are listening to Arab English Radio, and this is Muslim Lady, in which we're going to discuss all the matters of women. So I am Asma, your humble host for today's episode, and here with me I have my very dear friend, Sister Sadiqa, who is going to help us with the questions. Assalamu alaikum, sister.
Wa alaikum salam, and thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be back here again.
Well, the pleasure is all ours. Thank you for being here. Well, dear listeners, just as we promised, this is going to be the next segment for the story, the very sad story of infertility, which has got so much of burden on the side of the woman. So we talked about all the mental issues that would happen to a woman that is very much wishing to have a child, but she's not going to have a child of her own flesh and blood. This very idea is going to kill her, by the way. But then we talked that the environment, the people who are surrounding them, the family or friends must be so supportive and help them through this way. And a lot more of these kind of stuff. But now we're going to look at the Islamic perspective regarding... what we call as infertility in women. So is there some direct narrations about infertility of women?
Yes, there are. They're quite... before we get into infertility, I just wanted to mention a short point.
Mm-hmm.
So even though Islam looks at childbearing in a very positive light and encourages couples to have children, Islam also does come along and understands that it's not always going to happen. And we do have many traditional narrations that we've discussed in previous segments about miscarriage and how even miscarriage is looked in a positive light. I mean, positive light in the meaning that even the child is going to intercede for the parents on the Day of Judgment. So because Islam looks at it that there would be problems in carrying a child to term, infertility as well has been mentioned in the Quran. And we have the story of Prophet Zakaria. So Prophet Zakaria, like we know, did not have a child of his own till he was quite old.
Yeah.
And that was because his wife could not conceive.
And his wife was totally barren.
Yes, she could not conceive at all. Yeah. And they're both in a very old age. Now when we see the story of how Prophet Zakaria got a child, it is very interesting.
And inspiring, of course.
And very inspiring because it also gives us ways of how women can overcome infertility.
Yeah. Hope. And the doors of hope are
exactly.
open.
Exactly. And the doors of hope and prayers. Now, we have, obviously, we have the medical side of it that women should not ignore. Couples should not ignore,
of
especially
course,
if
yes.
there are medical issues surrounding infertility. But when it is unexplained infertility, as it does come along in some cases, let's look at the story of Prophet Zakaria. So in Surah Ali Imran, verse 36 to 38.
Mm-hmm.
It discusses that Prophet Zakaria enters the room where the mihrab where Hazrat Maryam was praying.
The altar.
Yes. And he saw a plate of fruits over there.
Yeah.
Fruits that were not in season according to the traditions.
Yes, yes.
And he's very surprised and he asks her, where did you get this? And she replies, God gives to whom he wishes.
Yeah.
You know, it's like a thunderstorm bolt to Prophet Zakaria.
Yeah.
And that desire to have a child from Allah who's the all giver comes into him. The verse says, there and then... He prayed for a child.
That is very nice.
And Allah tells him, we will give you a child.
Yes.
That prayer worked, right? Now, there are two points over here I'd like to mention. First is, Prophet Zakaria in this issue realized he's a prophet. He already knows this. But sometimes we do require to understand us as humans, not Prophet Zakaria. This story serves as an example that Allah is the all giver.
Yeah.
And as we learn to understand this, it becomes easier for us to accept that, look...
You mean we leave it to the hands of God.
Exactly. We did not choose to come into this world.
Yeah.
Allah brought us here. So in some cases, Allah chooses not to bring a person into this world, right?
Yes.
So he chooses not to bring a child to
this
specific...
And maybe it's the test of your life, you know?
Exactly. Like the Quran also speaks about this, that your wealth and your children are a test for you.
Yeah.
So understand this, that... It is a test, but Allah is the all giver.
Exactly. He's always there.
Exactly. And the second point I'd like to mention is that Hazrat Zakaria prayed in the mihrab of Hazrat Maryam. In my opinion, this indicates that praying in specific places has a better result. Right? So if you pray in a place that there's more of a sanctuary that has more sanctity, like Hazrat Maryam's mihrab was where she used to pray. And Hazrat Maryam has an amazing status in the Quran.
Exactly.
There's a whole surah dedicated to her. So
yes.
Hazrat Zakaria prayed in the mihrab of Hazrat Maryam. So when the women, not women, couples, I'll rephrase
exactly,
it. Couples,
yes.
When they're going through problems, not only infertility, any other problem.
Any kind of problem.
And since it's the topic of infertility, go to the places of those who are great. You know, like we have the shrines of the Ahlul Bayt, the masajids, the mosques where people go, they frequent every day.
Yeah.
You pray over there. These are the places where Allah is glorified. Use those places and pray to Allah in those places.
Let's go for a little break and I'll be back in no time. Thank you for listening.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
I'd actually like to mention a story. This is a personal friend, right?
Yeah.
They struggled with infertility for about 5 years. They went through IVF. They conceived, and in the 6th month, they miscarried the child.
Wow.
Now, obviously, when you have a miscarriage in IVF, you do feel very hopeless because you have
gone through... It's a breakdown.
It really affects the person.
Exactly,
so this couple actually came to Iran. They went to the shrine of Imam Ridha, alayhi salam, and they prayed. And I know this couple
personally. And of course, he will never let anyone down.
Exactly. And when they went back, as soon as they returned, they were able to conceive naturally. And they went on to have another pregnancy after that as well, conceived naturally.
Yeah,
now, this
is
a couple
nice.
Who has struggled with IVF. Now, I'm not saying that couples should not go for the medical route, but what I'm saying is that keep prayer alongside
your
health, alongside your doctor appointments. Keep both of them together because prayers, like Allah says, dhikr of Allah is a sort of contentment, is a source of contentment for the heart. So a person who continuously prays, going through those struggles, it brings a level of contentment and peace in the heart.
Yes.
So a couple can take a deep breath and understand Allah is there. I will do what is my responsibility.
Yes.
And Allah will do what is His responsibility and what He thinks is right. The couple will do what they have to do and Allah will do what He has to do. So as we keep prayers and these two together, inshallah, there should be a positive result for those who
are
struggling.
And by the way, you know, we have seen plenty much of couples who do not have children at all, but still the institution of their marriage is doing well and they're very loving and they care for each other. So I get it that the idea of procreating in a religion is very important, and not just in our religion, in all humanity. The idea behind marriage is to have some children of your own flesh and blood, of someone to carry your name. All these things are existing, but still, maybe it is not meant for all people to be parents. We should come to a point to embrace this very fact that maybe it is not meant for me to be a mother.
Or it could be that maybe there's other solutions they could go for as well. Because
of course.
I think coming down to a woman who really craves to have a child and is unable to do so, they should always keep the hope in mind.
That is very important.
So IVF, obviously the Islamic jurisprudential rules surrounding IVF, and those can be discussed. And then there's also another route, adoption.
Yes, that's very true.
Also, adoption is welcomed with its own jurisprudential rules, mm-hmm. which the scholars are obviously very well qualified to answer these questions. But if a couple is unable to conceive and they've exhausted all their routes and there's nothing more, then, you know, maybe they can go for adoption. They can look at the jurisprudential rules surrounding adoption and go for that as well. And inshallah, you know, they have someone to care. And sometimes people are not very comfortable with adoption.
Yeah.
But we do see there's so many orphanages which require, you know, these mothers have a whole world of love to give. And that love can always, if they're able to go into orphanages mm-hmm. and volunteer over there, love those children like their own, God knows how much reward they will be getting. Because, you know, we have so much emphasis on loving orphans.
Exactly,
and
yeah.
treating them with the best of respect.
Giving them the life they actually deserve to have.
Exactly. So if, you know, if these women who have a whole world of love to give are able to volunteer a few of the hours to go yeah. into those orphanages, sit with these kids, love them like their own, and, you know, make them understand that you don't have a parent, I don't have a child.
Yeah.
But we can obviously, we will be with each other. We will love each other. And yeah. you know that love that she has to give, she's able to direct it.
The two of them would complete themselves.
Exactly. They will. One has a lot of love to give and one needs a lot of love.
Exactly. Yeah, that's very nice.
And, you know, hopefully this can create a big pathway towards her own, creating a whole load of Jannah for herself in the hereafter.
Yeah.
And who knows, through the du'as of these orphans, in the end, she might actually end up conceiving herself.
Exactly.
As well.
And we have heard many stories, you know. We have plenty of examples.
Another thing to mention is that we mentioned in the previous segment that that women think it's guilt, and some people within a whole Islam, you know, they might try to be well-wishers again, but they come down with ideas such as, because you sinned, therefore God is punishing you.
Oh, no.
Please do not think that.
Yeah.
God is not a revengeful Lord.
Exactly.
114 times in the Quran, Allah calls himself. 113 times he starts in the Quran with him introducing himself as Ar-Rahman and Ar-Rahim. Allah is not here to take revenge.
He's the most merciful of all.
Exactly. Sometimes our actions can cause us to go through problems, such as maybe, you know, diet and stress, but it is not because of your sin. Hazrat Zakaria did not sin for him and his wife to not be able to have children. So our actions can lead to problems, but it's not necessarily a sin. But yes, sometimes by doing good, by giving charity, if there is any tribulation that's supposed to come on a couple,
yeah.
we have narrations that state if you do good, those tribulations are taken away. Now, given that infertility itself is a test and in some cases a tribulation for some couples, by doing good, inshallah, those tribulations can be averted from them as well. And the du'as of those around them, the prayers of those around them can come back and bring good for them. And, you know, they're, inshallah, they're able to have a natural...
Because when many people are praying for you, it's actually very different from the time when you are praying for yourself all alone.
Yes, because it is said when a person prays for another, Allah is very merciful. He looks at that prayer with a very positive light mm-hmm. and accepts it, especially if those who are praying are very innocent. Like we were talking around on the lines of orphan children, because those orphans have had such a hard life. Inshallah, their prayers can come back and have a good effect on this couple.
Yeah, that is very true. Thank you, sister. So this is all the time we had. Infertility is not going to define a woman. So it is always hope that is going to help you through the journey. Thank you, dear listeners.
Who is the lover?
Allah.
Who is Ar-Rahman?
Allah.
Who is Al-Mannan?
La ilaha illallah. Muhammadur Rasulullah.
The Quran, given by God to Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him and his family, more than 1400 years ago, as guidance for humanity. Quran speaks about women.
The Quran teaches the equality of men and women in the eyes of Allah.
Chapter 33, verse 35.
All praise is due to the one and only. He is the master of all creation.
Modesty and chastity are encouraged by the Quran, both for women and for men.
Chapter 24, verses 30 and 31.
He is the sustainer and the maintainer of the whole universe.
God created us from one male and one female and made us into nations and tribes so that we make to know one another, not to despise each other.
Chapter 49, verse 13.
La ilaha illallah, Muhammadur Rasulullah. Muhammad is the messenger to Allah.
The Quran has indicated worthy women in history just as it has mentioned such men and has commended them greatly.
Chapter 3, verse 37.
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
At the start of the COVID pandemic in March of 2020, the UK Health Department gave the first contract worth £133 million to healthcare firm Randox, without allowing any other firms to bid. The British government has suspended normal rules for awarding contracts as the pandemic was deemed to be an emergency. We have prepared for you an article written jointly by Rob Evans, David Pegg and Felicity Lawrence. The piece is titled UK Health Department Played Fast and Loose When Awarding COVID Contracts to Randox. Please stay with us for more. The head of the UK Parliament's spending watchdog has said ministers and government officials played fast and loose when awarding £777 million in COVID contracts to a healthcare firm that employed the Conservative MP Owen Paterson as a lobbyist. In a damning report, the House of Commons Public Accounts Committee concluded that the government made a series of failures, making it impossible to know if the contracts had been awarded properly to Randox. the cross-party committee of MPs found that the Department of Health and Social Care did little to deal with potential conflicts of interest, despite clear concerns about Randox's political connections. It added that officials were aware that Patterson had been in direct contact with Matt Hancock, who was then the health secretary, while promoting Randox. The MPs found that Randox made substantial profits after it was given the contracts to carry out COVID testing during the pandemic. According to the House of Commons Public Accounts Committee, which questioned whether they were excessive, the firm's profits in the year to June 2021 were more than 100 times greater than the previous year. In its latest accounts, Randox reported a profit of £177 million for the year to 30th of June 2021. The MP said this compared with a profit of just £1.2 million that Randox reported for the 18 months up to 30th of June 2020. A Randox spokesperson accused the House of Commons Public Accounts Committee report of being deeply flawed and wrong in assumptions it makes and the conclusions that it draws, and added the firm had issued a legal complaint. He claimed at no stage, either during its deliberations or in its preparation of this report, did the House of Commons Public Accounts Committee make any contact whatsoever with Randox. Consequently, many elements of its report relating to Randox are false, based as they are on wrong and unchecked assumptions about the company. A spokesperson for the company has previously claimed that Randox contracts were awarded in full compliance with government procedures and protocols in place at a time of the emerging pandemic. House of Commons Public Accounts Committee also concluded that the Health Department did not keep proper records of why it gave the contracts to Randox, nor of what happened when ministers met the company. The department was approached for comment. The publication of the report comes after Randox and Patterson were accused of cronyism in parliamentary debates. Randox paid Patterson, then MP for North Shropshire, £100,000 a year. The former cabinet minister was forced to resign from Parliament last November when he wrongly used his parliamentary position to lobby for his clients, including Randox. Evidence of his lobbying had originally been uncovered by The Guardian. The Liberal Democrats won the subsequent by-election, and the lobbying saga, including attempts by Boris Johnson to force his MPs to change the rules to protect Patterson, contributed to fury within the party and among voters, which ultimately led to Prime Minister Boris Johnson's downfall recently. Between 2010 and 2018, Randox donated £160,000 to the Conservative Party. During the pandemic, Patterson directly lobbied Hancock on behalf of Randox. After Patterson's lobbying, Matt Hancock chased his officials, saying he was very worried about how his department was treating Randox and other firms. The House of Commons Public Accounts Committee concluded that the department's woeful and poor record-keeping means that we cannot be sure that all these contracts were awarded properly. Even allowing for the exceptional circumstances at the start of the pandemic, basic civil service practices to document contract decision-making were not followed. It said that the Health Department neglected to scrutinise obvious conflicts of interest when it awarded the contracts, even though officials knew of Owen Patterson's contacts with Matt Hancock. Between January and October of 2020, Owen Paterson and Matt Hancock exchanged messages 8 times over private email or WhatsApp while the MP promoted Randox. Matt Hancock has claimed he did nothing wrong. The MP said officials were also aware that Matt Hancock had received hospitality from Randox in 2019, when he stayed overnight at a country estate owned by the head of the firm. Matt Hancock said he did not need to publicly declare this hospitality. The UK Health Department was also criticised for failing to meet the basic rule for publicly declare meetings between ministers and outside firms. Only 4 out of the 8 meetings between Randox and health ministers were made public, as they should have been. Records of what was said at only 2 of these meetings were kept. At the start of the COVID pandemic in March of 2020, the Health Department gave the first contract worth £133 million to Randox, without allowing any other firm to bid. The government had suspended normal rules for awarding contracts as the coronavirus pandemic was deemed to be an emergency. The House of Commons Public Accounts Committee said the award of this contract did not receive the scrutiny we would expect from the department's senior civil servants. The role of the department's ministers in approving the contract was also confused and unclear. The MPs added, Randox struggled to deliver the expected level of testing capacity against its first contract, which did not set out any performance measures. Yet the department still awarded Randox a contract extension worth £328 million 7 months later, again without any competition. Meg Hillier, the House of Commons Public Accounts Committee's chair, said, "We repeatedly hear the reference to the crisis we were facing as a nation, but acting fast doesn't mean acting fast and loose." She added that much of the business was won without any competing tenders from companies who may have had better capacity to deliver, pointing out that Randox had also been given money to pay for equipment to conduct the testing. A spokesperson for Matt Hancock said Randox was Britain's largest testing provider. Not to work with them during this unprecedented global pandemic would have been a dereliction of duty.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.